ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, I'm interviewing award-winning executive producer and game designer Blaine Grabois. Blaine is pioneering skill-based video games with real money casino floor gaming by creating the world's first video game gambling machines. He has founded multiple successful startups where he's contributed to raising over $20 million. And he's an active member of the Producers Guild of America. Blaine, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Glad to join.
Fantastic. Let's start by giving me and the audience just the Cliff Notes version of your story.
Sure. I started out my career in New York. I was the co-founder of the first DVD company based in New York. We were called Zuma Digital. We were involved in the entertainment business and fine arts community. We built that business through the late 90s and sold it in 2001 to a group called Tape House, who then sold it again. And it still operates today as part of a conglomerate called Postworks, which is the largest post-production company in New York. I took a little bit of time off and went back to Vermont, where I'd gone to college. I went to Bennington College in southwestern Vermont. While I was up there, I connected with ICM, the talent agency. I eventually signed with ICM as the first digital producer and moved out to Los Angeles in late 2002. ICM was really the group that got me involved in video games. And I spent a few years consulting for DreamWorks through Shrek, Madagascar, and Over the Hedge. Worked on games for brands such as High School Musical and companies like Mattel and Hasbro, Sony and Warner Brothers. Eventually moved back east as a co-founder of a company called Worldwide Biggies. We were very early in what now is called transmedia, but then we called multi-platform. We created television, film, and games, and eventually transitioned into working in the esports space with professional video game competitions. I was the president of the North American StarCraft League, the largest StarCraft professional league in North America, helped companies like Ubisoft start their esports operations, and worked with companies like Wargaming around their Wargaming League. Eventually, that led me to interact with a number of casinos where I was working to bring esports. And to my surprise, the casinos weren't very excited about the proposition of bringing 5,000 gamers to the casino for a weekend of esports events. And when I dug into understanding more why, the reasoning was that casinos make the vast majority of all their profits from slot machines, and young people don't play slot machines. So it created a disconnect between the entertainment opportunities and the audience that we were bringing to the casino. And it was folks at Caesars that said, well, if there was only a way to bring esports to the casino floor, that would be the next billion-dollar opportunity for us. And as I learned more about it, I realized this was a issue that many casinos were dealing with. And as I've gotten more into the industry over the last 3 years, I would say it's something of a crisis where casinos are working to appeal to Gen X and millennial gamers, but don't have the products to support that. And so we've been focused at GameCo on the last 3 years of building what we call the video game gambling machine, or VGM. The product looks like an arcade cabinet or slot machine. It features a custom controller that we've designed that's robust and ruggedized for the casino environment, but also simplified so it's easy for consumers to pick up and play. And we license popular video games and adapt them to our platform to run in the casino environment. We're currently in testing with the Division of Gaming Enforcement in New Jersey and working towards fielding our first machines with major casinos this fall in Atlantic City ultimately will be selling and operating our product in every jurisdiction that currently supports slot machines and electronic gaming machines.
You know, one of the things I thought was really interesting when looking at your bio was the hurdles you had to pass. I mean, you needed legislation to pass in Vegas to have the skills-based gaming in the casino, didn't you?
So interestingly, we build our products under a standard called GLI 11. That is an existing standard that governs slot machines and electronic gaming machines. Some jurisdictions like New Jersey and Nevada do have specialized skill gaming regulations. And what that allows us to do is add new features to our games that are specific to that jurisdiction. We are currently working with AGEM, the Association of Gaming Equipment Manufacturers, as well as GLI themselves, Gaming Laboratories International, to have the GLI 11 standards accepted as something of a baseline for skill gaming.
Right.
And GLI is currently expanding their GLI 11 standards to allow for new capabilities around skill gaming, but it's not necessarily a requirement that jurisdictions pass new legislation. It's more our focus that they are supporting the current regulations as a baseline for skill gaming and then adding to it to support new capabilities.
Right. One of the things also that's very interesting is looking at the trajectory of your career is you built a DVD business when tape and VHS still reigned supreme, and you ended that business or converted that business before DVDs hit their peak. And now you're entering another untapped market. And I wonder, how do you identify the opportunities for entry? And how do you know it's time for you to move on to something else?
So I've made a career of firsts, and I'm very proud of that. We were the first DVD company in New York. I've been involved in a number of other firsts, making the first set-top games for DirecTV, some of the first DVD board games. I've had some firsts that have been successes and some firsts that have been failures. For example, we had a business called Silver Platter. We were the first UMD publisher. UMD was a failed format that was created by Sony to play on their PlayStation Portable. But that actually did lead to a very successful line of business bringing content to gaming platforms. And now when you look at PlayStation and Xbox today, they're definitely entertainment platforms. So I would say on my side, I'm always looking for opportunities that are firsts, but firsts in very large markets that are growing and have the opportunity to be billion-dollar businesses. In terms of time to exit, I would say that I have a focus and my partners have a focus on exiting at a time where we've provided value to the business and investors, but also value to the industry in which we are working and sort of proving the model before we exit. We're, you know, very much looking to be early in a business, but also prove that a business can be successful and that an industry is going to be successful. And obviously, there's a balance between exiting at the right time in terms of the financial opportunity and the requirement that it's going to take to scale the business to the next level. So we're very much looking for that inflection point of where we've added value and proven the opportunity, but also at a certain plateau or marker before the next level of scaling is required. So in the DVD business, the next level of scaling would have been being a national or international business. I would say in our current video game gambling business, we're very interested in growing the business and proving the opportunity, but there will definitely be a moment in the next 3 to 5 years where scaling that into a larger national or international business is something that is likely better done by a partner.
Right.
And so I'd say that scaling factor is very critical as we're evaluating the potential to exit a business.
It's interesting. Bezos was talking about Amazon betting and then failing, and that failure was fine. It was just knowing when to exit the failure. So in this UMD situation, how did you know when to just cut your losses?
So I would say it was early in the days of eBay, and I should have been a little bit more aggressive in using eBay as a tool for pricing our product. And I would say the moment where we realized it wasn't going to be a successful business for us, we started selling our UMD discs on eBay, which provided a more accurate or natural opportunity to see what consumers were willing to pay for the product in the marketplace. And what we saw was that the consumers were only willing to pay a much lower price than we had been targeting at retail. And when we ran the numbers at that pricing level, it was obvious that it wasn't going to be the same level of success that we were targeting in the overall business. So in that case, it was really getting a better read on the actual consumer feedback of what they were willing to pay for the product in the marketplace, and that it was such a disconnect between what we and other manufacturers were trying to command through retail.
Right, right. Fascinating. So it really is. It's interesting pinpointing when to enter, when to exit, and also where the gaps are, and that's your opportunity, how you realize that there's this opportunity in casinos because these millennials aren't using slot machines, which in some ways should have been an obvious thing. Why would they? It's pretty boring, right? You know, you've got people who grew up playing Game Boys, PlayStations, they have iPhones. Why would they be interested in games that look like they run on Windows 95? So it's an interesting thing that this is a gap that you noticed. Now, was this something that you came to them, or they said, gee whiz, if you could only fix this problem?
So I would say it was a bit of a combination. I was trying to bring esports to the casinos, so in that sense, I was approaching them, but very quickly saw that it wasn't a match for their business. And so it was the folks at Caesars, as well as a group called Rock Gaming, now known as Jack Entertainment, owned by a gentleman named Dan Gilbert in Detroit. And it was really the two of them. They both said the exact same thing, which is, if there was only a way to bring esports to the casino floor, that would be a huge opportunity and a major solution to the problem we're encountering. And so it led to doing a lot more research in this space. We're a very research and data-driven organization and try to do the research and build out the data to figure out how to approach a business. So in the case of the casino space, it was really two main things. We did a survey to 10,000 employees of Quicken Loans, and the survey data that came back was just so obvious in terms of the fall off of slot players and the insurgence of video games in general in the marketplace. And then we also did a few casino nights at the Quicken Loans offices in Detroit, and just seeing the feedback, doing exit interviews, and talking to actual consumers, it was so obvious that we were solving a problem for the consumers as well as the casinos. On the casino side, they're trying to attract this new younger audience. But on the consumer side, there really was an interest in going to the casino. There just wasn't anything that was engaging for them. Consumers saw the casino as a real VIP, sexy, cool environment that they wanted to take part in, but there just wasn't the entertainment factor that they were looking for there. As you pointed out, you know, they were entertained by Xbox and mobile games, and they weren't finding that experience at the casino. Interestingly, though, you mentioned that it looks like it runs on Windows 95. Not quite Windows 95, but the vast majority of casino games actually run on Windows 7, which is really interesting as we learned about that more, including our games run on Windows 7.
Oh, well, then we've got to be kinder, right? So it's interesting. You guys do a lot of data and research. Looking more broadly, what media consumption trends are you seeing among millennials beyond, you know, Twitch beating TV, which it's quite impressive. What other trends and changes are you seeing among this new generation?
Sure. So very interestingly, I know that demographics are important in age. You know, the millennial versus Gen X versus boomer is a very effective way to parse the audience. But in terms of trends, I would say we look beyond age groups and really look at activity. And so the biggest thing that we see is that video games are right on the cusp of being mainstream. The vast majority of U.S. households are gamer households. They have one or more console or PC gaming platforms. A majority of adults in all age categories, right up to boomers, self-identify as gamers. And so recently I had someone say to me, well, if a decade ago I could have known that nerd culture would be mainstream culture, I would have created the Big Bang Theory. And so I think very similarly, video games and gamers are the largest underserved demographic. They're still stereotyped as being kids in their parents' basement, but there's actually more adult female gamers than male teenage gamers. So from our standpoint, video games are really one of the biggest trends that are in many ways being swept under the rug because of outdated stereotypes. Just this morning, I saw something posted online. A major AAA video game publisher, I won't name names because they're a company that I respect in many other ways, they had a survey up online. The first survey question that they asked was gender, and they only gave the options of male and female for gender, which I think, you know, speaks to a certain bias already. As soon as you answered female, it cut off the survey for respondents that answered female. They essentially weren't interested in getting feedback from female gamers. And maybe they had a reason for it. Maybe it was a male-only gamer survey. And if that was the case, they really should have been more forthright about that from the beginning. But if you look at the marketplace, about 50% of gamers are female, depending on the genre of games and the age demographic that you're looking at. And so I think it's really important to look at a holistic view of the marketplace. And in this case, gamers are all ages. They're millennials, Gen X, and boomers. They're close to 50-50 male-female, depending on the genre and age that you're looking at. And so I think that's a huge media consumption trend that's being overlooked. 2007 was the last year that a movie beat a video game in first week revenues.
Wow.
So people talk about these movies like Avatar or Star Wars, but they're dwarfed by things like Fallout and Call of Duty and Grand Theft Auto. And so it's really an amazing trend that's happening in the marketplace that is just being overlooked because of these outdated stereotypes.
If you're a traditional media player, you know, you're a network and you know this piece of information, how could you use that? I mean, what would that mean for you? And what would you vision the impact of not knowing that this gaming component is there? How would that affect how you construct your programming, promote your programming, execute your programming? Or even if you're a studio, you're getting beaten by games. What does that mean you should be doing?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think digital distribution is hugely important for content producers and publishers. I'm a board member of the Producers Guild of America. It's something that people are constantly engaging with me about. How do I leverage digital distribution? And I think there's a fear of piracy that if you're using digital distribution as a primary means, you're going to see additional piracy. But I'm of the belief that if you make your product available to consumers in a way that they want to consume it, they're willing to pay for it. And if you look at surveys and trends around that, that's generally supported. Generally, when you engage with a younger audience and you ask them the reasons why they pirated content, they won't say that they're not willing to pay for it, but they will say things like, it wasn't available to me at the time or method that I wanted to watch it, and or it wasn't priced at the level that I was willing to pay for it, which gets back to that failure that we had at Silver Platter, which I think was really interesting. We were putting content onto a physical medium that wasn't necessarily the way that people wanted to consume it. But then additionally, we were pricing it at a level that was well above what they were willing to pay for it. And so I think that if you meet the distribution needs and the consumption needs, both in terms of availability and pricing, that you're going to sell more product to more people and make more money.
I guess the question then becomes, is it economically sustainable. I think that's probably where the rub comes, is that they're not sure, sort of to your UMD point, is the price people are willing to pay sufficient? However, if they're pirating in any way, you know, something is better than nothing.
Well, I would say one of the things that I find that's the biggest challenge in today's market, as we're transitioning from, let's use the example of television on TV versus television on Hulu and Netflix and Amazon, is the disparity in advertising revenue or advertising price point between the two mediums. Google has done such an amazing job at driving down the cost of advertising digitally that it's created a huge gap between the advertising revenue that you can generate from the same viewership digitally versus what you're able to charge for that on television. And so one of the things that's going to have to happen over the next few years is a leveling of what people are willing to pay for digital advertising to reach that same audience that they would have been reaching on traditional TV, but they're going to have to pay a little bit more for it. So without television advertising considerably coming down, we're going to need digital advertising revenues to increase fairly dramatically so that content producers and publishers and distributors can afford to do it in the same way. On the flip side, we're seeing new business models arise, you know, subscription models around Netflix and Spotify and HBO, all things that I subscribe to because they have content that I really love. And I have to imagine that if Netflix is spending $6 billion on content development, that their subscription model is working for them.
Interestingly, did you see just today announced that Netflix is going to be on Comcast?
I think that's super interesting. Again, you need to make things available to people in the way that they want to consume them. So if I'm a Comcast customer and that's my preferred method for internet and cable, well, why wouldn't you make Netflix available to me there? Those companies are going to have to come to agreements that are amenable to both sides and work inside each of their business models. But the ultimate choice is with the consumer. And consumers want to watch things on the platforms and at the times and the methods that they choose. If I, for whatever reason, want to watch something on my phone, why would you restrict me from doing that?
Absolutely. Just shifting gears a teeny bit, it seems like everyone's betting on VR. Will it go mainstream? Is it a game changer for gaming? Steve Wozniak recently said that if he was a kid now, he would enter VR and build programs for VR. And Bill Gates said something similar, saying that it's all anyone in computer science is thinking about now. What's your perspective?
I think VR is super interesting, but I still have yet to see the killer application that's going to drive the consumer adoption. I've tested most of the hardware and software. I've been to a number of the purpose-built experiences, and it still feels very much like a niche amusement at this point. Honestly, the hardware that I'm the most interested in is Microsoft's HoloLens, and that's because it's so obvious the practical applications of augmented reality in terms of fixing my car, doing plumbing. It just feels like a very obvious application there. I know it's a little bit less consumer oriented and more professionally oriented, but that's the one area that feels the most tangible to me. I have seen some VR games that I think are really exciting, but I don't necessarily think that they're that much more exciting than a really well-produced Xbox or PlayStation game or PC game or even mobile game. The immersion factor isn't necessarily the driving factor around content.
Right.
And so I think ultimately what we need are developers and creatives that are making things that really tap into that opportunity.
Right, right, where they make it something different. I think it's interesting when you also think about millennials and the youth generation and how much they're willing to do it for a one-off, but will they unplug from their phone so that they can be in an experience? Whereas if you're gaming on a regular Xbox, you can have your tablet, your laptop, your phone all at the same time.
And I think that's a good point that you just touched on. I think another stereotype that exists that I don't necessarily agree with is this idea that whether it's about millennials or Gen X or gamers or these different demographics, that they're not social. Humans are social beings. We want to be with our friends and peers. The fact that people are enjoying digital entertainment and using their phones more often doesn't mean that they don't want to connect with other people. If you look back, that same sort of stereotype, outdated concern has been voiced around so many other technologies historically. I remember reading once that the exact same concern was voiced about newspapers. And now that newspapers were being published on a daily basis, no one was going to read novels. And nothing's further from the truth. They're just different forms of content and entertainment. And I would say one of the challenges is that there is so much more, you know, more channels, more methods and platforms for consuming things. And so it does put more choice on the consumer side of what am I interested in? And I think that's really the bigger driver now is, you know, what are my interests and how am I being provided with ways to engage in those interests?
Right. Well, it's interesting. HBO CEO said that he didn't feel that other networks were his competition. He felt that other choices were his competition, that he is competing with anything that a consumer wants to do. He's competing for free time.
I couldn't agree with anything more than that. You know, the price point of HBO Now, which I subscribe to, it's super reasonable. I think it's like less than $10 a month. You get a ton of content. So from a price standpoint, that's not the biggest barrier, if you will. The biggest barrier is, do we get it from Netflix? Do we get it from Amazon? Do we get it from HBO? And who has the content that we're most interested in? That's really what's driving it. You know, first, as you were saying, the time. I have the time to watch something. I want to have the passive entertainment experience. And then the question is, where am I getting that from? I don't think that price is the major barrier.
Right. So let's shift. What's next? What does the future hold? Looking into the crystal ball of what new media can look like. What do you think? Is someone going to sail in and make what you're doing right now obsolete? Are you going to be disrupted?
Well, I think we'll have a good run at it. At GameCo, we're working in a very regulated industry, and innovation happens slowly in a regulated space. And I feel like we are moving about as fast as we can. It's taken us about 3 years now to go from concept to prototype to now we're manufacturing our first product and getting it onto the casino floor this year. I think it would be very, very difficult to innovate any faster. And people are always asking us, well, when am I going to see VR on the casino floor? And my answer to that is it would be very, very difficult in today's regulatory environment to make a VR product that would be appropriate and acceptable inside of a casino environment. That said, I will never put a time frame on it. When we started doing GameCo, people in the industry said, Blaine, that's the future, but that's 20 years away. We came back the next year, Blaine, definitely still the future, but that's 10 years away. You know, came back the next year, Blaine, definitely still the future, but that's 5 years away. And now 3 years later, those same people that started out saying it was 20 years, well, they're our customer 3 years later. So it would be very disingenuous of me to say all these things are 5, 10, 20 years out. But I do think that what we're building at GameCo is going to be very valid and mainstream for the next 5 or 10 years. That doesn't mean it won't be supplemented and augmented with other entertainment experiences. But I think the pace of innovation in a regulated space is limited in how quickly you can move.
If you're working not in a regulated space, how do you manage to make yourself aware of potential disruption threats? How do you co-opt those threats? How do you anticipate them? How do you go about doing that?
Sure. So I would say that being very open is super important. It's really easy to get myopic in your own space and not look outside of it. Just to use the example of casinos, it's not uncommon that we meet with people in the casino industry that say things like, I've been in this business for 30 years and I've never done anything else. And they're not aware of the ascendance of esports and video games just because they're so myopic in their own industry. I would say a good way to get exposed to new things is conferences and public events. And I try to contribute to as many as possible because there's so much to learn when you go to an industry event that's bringing together people from sports and video games and entertainment. And you get to see a lot of what's driving new business in each of those areas. And then I'm a big believer in intuition. So you've got to make a choice and stick with it for a while. I think that's a really critical thing that I learned. I had a sculpture professor in college, and he said to us one day in class, don't chase trends, find something that you believe in and that you can stick with. And eventually you're going to intersect with the mainstream audience. And I would say that's something that we found at GameCo where, you know, again, when we started this, people were like, yeah, it's the future, but it's 20 years out. We believed in it intuitively, and what we saw is that it was the future and it wasn't 20 years out, it was 2 to 5 years out. So I think having a strong sense of intuition and believing in that is really critical for entrepreneurs and business owners, because it's so easy to chase a trend, but you're always going to be behind if you're chasing. You've got to commit to something that you believe in and that you're willing to do, even at those really dark days that everything seems against you.
Right. So what's next for you, if you were to imagine it?
Well, every year for the last few years, I've been saying this is the year for esports. When you look at the trajectory over the next 5-10 years, I definitely think there's going to be a time where the esports audience crosses over even the largest sports audience, which would be Super Bowl. And so I think that there's a really interesting growth trajectory around esports. Right now, for all the attention that esports is getting, it still is very small when you look at the participants. And so, you know, if you think about a pyramid, what's happening right now in esports is really the top of the pyramid that would correspond in traditional sports to the professional leagues like NFL and MLB. But what about the whole rest of the pyramid, little league and middle school and high school sports and collegiate with NCAA? And I think that there's going to be an incredible growth that happens over the next 5 or 10 years around esports. And if you look at a game like Overwatch from Blizzard, Blizzard is a company that was really early in massive multiplayer games with things like Warcraft. They basically invented the space. They were able to leverage Warcraft into one of the first esports games around StarCraft. And then look at the work that they did on Overwatch, where they took a very discerning approach to making a game specifically targeted towards esports. And in launching that game, they've already created something that's a top 5 esports game. It's so interesting to me how Blizzard was able to take the time and dedication and focus to make a game that at launch is already a top 5 in a huge industry. There's an enormous amount of opportunity over the next 5 to 10 years to make esports more watchable and more mainstream. Right now, the vast majority of the broadcasts that are happening in the esports space are still oriented towards the insider professional that understands it. But when you look at, let's say, football, for example, they've done such an amazing job of making the game accessible to even the most casual viewer. And there's just an enormous amount of opportunity still in that space around esports.
When we were speaking earlier about gender split and gaming in terms of participation, you're saying it's 50-50. Is participation in esports as an audience participation, is that also equal by gender?
It depends on the game, or rather the game genre. So I would say it's not quite equal at the highest level. I bet Twitch's overall numbers are closer to 70-30 male-female. But the female broadcaster and the female audience is definitely one of the segments that's growing the fastest. And it gets back to making content that is interesting and accessible to them. I think as more broadcasters and more entertainers start to get into the space, they're going to make shows that are more accessible and more interesting to a more diverse audience. There's already enough programming that's aimed at that core core male gamer audience. And so I think people are definitely seeing the opportunity to appeal to that larger, both casual audience and female audience. And what's going to come with that, back to the conversation we were having earlier, those advertising dollars as well. As you make content that's accessible to a new audience, it opens up new advertising and promotional opportunities that people are looking for. Brands are definitely looking for that opportunity, and they don't have things they can advertise against right now.
What's interesting is the Olympics skews female vis-a-vis the typical sports viewer. And as a result, the general belief is that that's because the Olympics isn't about the result or the win. It's about the journey. And that's why we see a lot of the promotion about the journey, the story behind it. And it would be interesting to understand whether that is a static behavior of the female viewer, or as women are more interested in gaming and esports and things like that, if what appeals to women is shifting over time.
Absolutely. And I think you just touched on something that's really dear to my heart and interesting to me, which is story. There's almost nothing more powerful you can say than "let me tell you a story." That's what brings in interest and audience and attention, is character, story, narrative. And so I think as video games grow in character, story, and narrative, when you look at some of the most successful franchises, you look at something like Halo, it's going on 15 years now. It's definitely not just the gameplay that's provided that longevity. It's the fact that there's a really interesting story world there that's engaging to the audience that has created that opportunity for Halo to be moving into its second decade. And they've been able to expand it into TV, film, and other entertainment medium, because at the heart of it is a really strong character and story-driven narrative. Right. And so I think that you're touching on something that's really important. And it's not just for female audience. I think it's really for all audiences. We want to be engaged with entertaining story and with really fun characters that are believable and strong and that reflect aspects of our world and our personality. And the more people that developers and publishers and creators are able to deliver on that, the larger audience they're going to see.
Who do you know personally who is currently doing remarkable work that is going to change the way we think about media? Who do you think is the person to watch?
Wow. Well, one of my friends at the Producers Guild, Caitlin Burns, I think is doing some amazing work. She started in the transmedia space, building story worlds for films like Tron and Pirates of the Caribbean. And she's now transitioned into working in the virtual reality space primarily, but still with that character story-driven approach, but also a very data-driven approach. She's running a company called Datavised, where they're taking huge data sets and bringing them over to the VR space, but doing it around concepts and subjects that are very engaging from a narrative standpoint. And so I think Caitlin's doing some really amazing work in this space.
That sounds fascinating. Thank you so much for your time. I think your career, the trajectory, everything you've done is really amazing. It's so impressive that you were able to really see the opportunities, and not only see them, but that you actually then went ahead and did something about it. It really is so impressive. And I can't wait to see how things move forward with what you do.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that consideration and opportunity for the interview today. Thank you.
Thank you. We've reached the end of our second episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who've been indispensable to bringing this program to life. Of course, first and foremost, thank you to today's guest, Blaine Grayboys, for doing such an incredible interview. Thank you to the incomparable voice artist, my friend, Rob Naughton. Our production team over at Microfame Media, thank you. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.